This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. This week, Donald Trump has pushed the crisis in North Korea into even more dangerous territory. His most direct provocation came on Tuesday when he said North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. And as the international community expresses alarm over his words, he doubled down on them, tweeting on Wednesday that the U.S. nuclear arsenal is now stronger and more powerful than ever before. Hopefully, we will never have to use this power, but there will never be a time that we, meaning the United States, are not the most powerful nation in the world. The context for this saber rattling is the new U.S. intelligence report that North Korea has produced, a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside missiles. This, according to a report by the Washington Post. Further context is the new UN sanctions that have been imposed on North Korea. These strict sanctions cut up a third of the country's exports, blocking all exports of coal, iron ore, lead ore, and seafood, which could cost the country an estimated $1 billion a year. These new sanctions were said to be in response to North Korea's launching of two intercontinental ballistic missiles last month. The sanctions were approved unanimously by the UN Security Council, interestingly enough, including China and Russia. Meanwhile, China has also been urging both the United States and North Korea to avoid escalation. And back in the United States, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson stressing diplomacy and reassuring the U.S. that people could sleep well at night, while Defense Secretary James Mattis is going on the offensive, saying North Korea risked the end of its regime and the destruction of its people if it did not stand down. And in response to all of this, in particular to Trump, North Korea has set its sights on Guam. The North Korean military, in a statement late Wednesday, promised to finalize a plan this month to fire four mid-range missiles into the waters off Guam, which is a U.S. territory. The same statement from North Korea threatened to turn the U.S. mainland into the theater of a nuclear war. And according to Sputnik News, the Pentagon has prepared a contingency plan to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea, which may involve U.S. fighters on Guam, and a spokesman for U.S. ally South Korea has warned that the North, quote, will face a strong response from South Korea's military and the U.S.-South Korea alliance if there were any more provocations. I'd like to welcome our regular Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. And he's also, in his many books, written on the Asia-Pacific region. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so Dr. Horn, you certainly have raised on our weekly roundtable, where you are a regular panelist, the dangers of what is happening in the Pacific region and the kind of provocations going on, not only against North Korea, but against China. And to start off our discussion, I think it would be helpful for our audience to be reminded a little bit about that, the Korean War, that war in the Korean Peninsula that still isn't finished, really. Dr. Horn?
Well, you know that in mid-June 1950, a conflict erupted on the Korean Peninsula, and it eventually drew in the United Nations, actually the United States under United Nations flag. That war lasted from 1950 to 1953, and the tide was basically turned against the U.S. UN forces when China crossed the border and pushed back the U.S. UN forces. And so when you talk about today a crisis in North Korea, ultimately, you have to talk about China, not only because of that history I've just recounted, but also because North Korea and China are comrade regimes, if you like. Both are ruled by communist parties. It's interesting to note as well that the history of resistance in North Korea and China both mirror each other. Both take a very strong anti-Tokyo posture, not least because the Korean Peninsula was colonized by Japan between 1910 and 1945, and also the Chinese Communist Party gains its legitimacy because of the anti-Tokyo war that it waged from the 1930s up until the defeat of Japan in 1945. Interestingly enough, after President Harry Truman dropped atomic weapons on Japan in August 1945. Now, this crisis is also taking on an extremely explosive nature because of deteriorating relations between Beijing and Washington. There was a kind of false dawn after the Mar-a-Lago summit between President Xi Jinping and President Trump a few months ago. But that false dawn has evaporated. I point you to the Washington Post this morning, which carries a story about an imminent trade war between China and the United States, and trade wars oftentimes give rise to other kinds of war. And likewise, if you go to your local AMC theater complex, AMC, of course, is owned by a Chinese conglomerate, Darling and Wanda, you will find playing there, for example, Monterey Park, just 6 miles from Pasadena, this new Chinese blockbuster film, the biggest grossing Chinese film up to this point, called Wolf Warrior 2, which takes place in a fictional African country and features a Euro-American villain, the likes of which you've never seen, who is leading a kind of Boko Haram terrorist type of organization in this fictional African country that slays babies, and he is ultimately defeated by a Chinese force. I understand from reports that the audience, which was mostly Asian American in Monterey Park, applauded wildly after this Euro-American villain was defeated. This is just one more symptom of this deteriorating relationship between Washington and Beijing, which is stalking and haunting this exceedingly dangerous situation on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, and, you know, some people, I suppose, were surprised that China and Russia went along with the sanctions imposed, you know, by the UN Security Council, because it makes sense that neither China or Russia really wants any kind of war or destabilization in North Korea. So there's all the tough talk, and Trump, his rhetoric, which he thought was going to intimidate North Korea, clearly did not, given the response of North Korea. And in fact, Trump setting up a red line, because he says any more threats coming from Kim Jong-un will be, you know, met with this power and fire and fury. Well, guess what? Since he made that statement, there have been at least two further threats coming from North Korea, and it remains to be seen what Trump will do in response. But behind the scenes in all of the rhetoric, there seems to be some quiet diplomacy going on, because I'm seeing a report here that North Korea released a Canadian pastor. And this in the midst of all of this, you know, standoff. I mean, it is a Canadian pastor, but it seems to give an indication that North Korea, you know, is ready to do something to de-escalate. Dr. Horn, your view on why you think China and Russia went along with the sanctions that are going to be very, very tough on North Korea, but also will impact the Chinese economy. And, you know, just kind of the what do you think is going on here?
Well, point number one, I think that neither Beijing nor Moscow necessarily welcomes a nuclear-armed North Korea. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that if history is any guide, that China in particular will look the other way when its many firms conduct business relations with North Korea in contravention of these latest sanctions. Part of the problem on this side of the Pacific is that the State Department has been depleted. Top jobs have not been filled by Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, as he undergoes or seeks to execute a massive reorganization of the State Department. This is taking place as well in the context of bitter infighting in the White House itself between the Steve Bannon nationalists, the white supremacist wing of the White House staff, and General McMaster, the National Security Council. Breitbart News is conducting a kind of civil war against General McMaster, seeking to force him out. This means that the Trump team is not on the same page. They're all singing from different hymn books, which makes U.S. foreign policy more incoherent than it ordinarily is. Now, crossing back to the Pacific, it's clear that the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, has been trying to learn the lessons of history, one of which is that when Muammar Gaddafi in Libya turned over his nuclear stockpile or his attempt to develop a nuclear stockpile and denuded his government of nuclear weapons, that was a signal in 2011 for a NATO bombing campaign that eventually drove him out of office and led to his death. North Korea, the DPRK, feels that nuclear weapons are kind of an insurance policy. At the same time, I think if you look at U.S. strategy, the U.S. strategy is not only aimed at North Korea, it's not only aimed at China. Keep in mind that Vladivostok, Russia's window on the Pacific Ocean, is not that far distant from the DPRK. Moscow has been funneling gobs of capital into Vladivostok, and that has been supplemented by Chinese capital as well. Keep in mind as well that just south of the DPRK is South Korea, which happens to house major competitors such as Kia and Hyundai and Samsung to U.S. firms such as Apple and Ford and General Motors. And collateral damage to those South Korean firms would not necessarily be the cause of shedding of tears in the United States of America, certainly in the corporate suites. So this is a very complex scenario, but quite frankly, Washington is playing with fire. This is an ultimately dangerous situation, and the fact that Mr. Trump issued his fire and fury threat in August 2017, after in August 1945, President Truman threatened to have a rain of ruin, his words, upon Nagasaki after the bombing atomically of Hiroshima, makes this whole situation even more chilling and threatening.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the United States still provoking, or I should say further provoking China with the South China Sea Islands. I read something that I think a bomber, U.S. bomber, flew close to the, you know, right close to those islands. So, I mean, there's still some activity kind of warning China that the United States may be ready to make some military move there. But you mentioned South Korea, and of course, the demilitarized zone is still there, and the new president of South Korea, which was much more to the left than the previous prime minister of South Korea, and he had hoped that there could just be dialogue and talks with North Korea. And now it seems, in part because of the rhetoric from the United States and because of the strong sanctions from the United States, that North Korea is now saying that they are not prepared at all to have any kind of dialogue. Whether that is true or not, and whether any quiet diplomacy may already be taking place, we don't know. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that relationship with South Korea and North Korea, because it seems now the new president of South Korea is being pushed in the direction that he didn't want to go, including accepting these THAAD missiles that initially he had said that he didn't really want them in South Korea at all. And also the fact that there is a law in South Korea that so-named dissidents that flee North Korea to the south, but who now want to go back home, are denied. In fact, they're put in jail rather than allowing them to go back to North Korea. So you have family members that are really divided in this way. Your thoughts on this, Dr. Horn?
Well, anti-missile defense is a key and crucial component of this whole situation. The new regime in Seoul, South Korea, thus far has been backing away from the previous government's decision to install anti-nuclear or anti-missile defense. Recall that China objected strenuously when the decision was made by the previous Seoul regime to install this anti-missile defense, feeling, perhaps correctly, that anti-missile defense is really just a provocation aimed at China. Speaking of provocations aimed at China, it's not just the fact that the United States has been sailing its naval vessels into what China considers to be its territorial waters in the South China Sea, but recall that in July 2017, there were these massive naval maneuvers featuring the navies of the United States, India, and Japan, which China saw as a direct threat. This comes in the context of a standoff on the border separating China and India that's been taking place for weeks now. This takes place in the context of a sharp war that was fought in 1962 between India and China. And that war has not received as much attention that it deserves because it took place during the same time of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, the last time that the world came to the brink of the precipice of nuclear destruction, which apparently Mr. Trump is trying to lead us to as we speak.
Yeah, and also on Guam and why Guam? We know that Guam was occupied by the Japanese during World War II, where the indigenous population was basically terrorized and interned, actually. And guns were actually set up to massacre them, the indigenous people. And people forget that there is an indigenous population in Guam. I mean, it just didn't start with the Japanese invasion or now with the U.S. But what has happened is that Guam is now really central to U.S. military operations in the whole of the Pacific region. And it has been home to nuclear weapons, to mustard gas, and many other, you know, cancer-causing and really bad for people's health and the environment. In the 1980s, it is said the Navy discharged radioactive water into a harbor that people use for fishing and, you know, much more. So it's no accident that North Korea is threatening. And I noted they're not threatening to hit Guam. They're saying that, you know, the missiles will be fired close to Guam. And this is very different from the what's the rhetoric coming from the United States. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of North Koreans have hit the streets protesting the United States. Dr. Horn, just on the centrality of Guam and the fact that so many weapons are also pointed not only at North Korea, but at China.
Well, there is considerable concern and consternation, understandably, in Guam as we speak about this alleged attempt to launch missiles close to their territorial waters. This is obviously understandable why this consternation is growing, but it seems to me to be worsened and exacerbated by a blockbuster story that's just breaking on the front page of USA Today that talks about a scandal in the Catholic Church involving child sex abuse that dwarfs any of these other scandals that have hit Australia, United States, and other countries where the Catholic Church operates. This is happening as the Guam people begin to question even more deeply the decades of U.S. colonialism and U.S. imperialism that has been foisted upon this island. And as this drawn into the so-called missile bullseye, I dare say that this growing anti-U.S. imperialist sentiment will continue to flourish.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dr. Horn, we're going to continue this discussion on our weekly roundtable tomorrow, where I'm sure who knows what will happen between today and tomorrow. But meanwhile, the governor of Guam and some in the United States are trying to damp down fears of people who are thinking, well, my goodness, they may be hit with a nuclear weapon at any moment. And Donald Trump seems to be oblivious to what it might mean making a strike on North Korea that could actually lead to a nuclear war. So very dangerous times indeed. Dr. Horn, thank you for joining us. To be continued tomorrow. So tune into our weekly roundtable.